All right, we are in Deuteronomy 22, and the heading that's in my Bible is just like various laws. So if you want to turn to Deuteronomy 22, I love studying God's law because it is a reflection of God's character. And people say, oh, you know, what are we studying the Old Testament for? We're under grace and we're not under the law. The law is God's law. So therefore, God's law is perfect. And if we want to see the perfection of God, we can see that reflected in the laws that he gives. And chapter 22 of Deuteronomy is no exception. So let's begin reading with verse 1. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them. You shall take them back to your brother. And if he does not live near you and you do not know where he is, you shall bring it home to your house and it shall stay with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. And you shall do the same with his donkey, or with his garment, or with any lost thing of your brother's, which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. You shall help him to lift them up again. A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you, and that you may live long. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it. You should not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, lest the whole yield be forfeited, the crop that you have sown and the yield of the vineyard. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear cloth of wool or linen mixed together. You shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. If any man takes a wife and then goes into her and then hates her and accuses her of misconduct and brings a bad name upon her, saying, I took this woman, and when I came near her, I did not find in her evidence of virginity, then the father of the young woman and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of her virginity to the elders of the city in the gate. And the father of the young woman shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man to marry, and he hates her. And behold, he has accused her of misconduct, saying, I did not find in your daughter evidence of virginity. And yet this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloak before the elders of the city. Then the elders of the city shall take the man and whip him, and they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name upon a virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife, and he may not divorce her all his days. But if the thing is true, that evidence of virginity was not found in the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of the city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done an outrageous thing in Israel by whoring in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. So you shall purge evil from Israel. If there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. You shall purge the evil from your midst. But if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense punishable by death. For this case is like that of the man attacking and murdering his neighbor, because he met her in the open country, and though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found, then the man who lie with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has violated her. He may not divorce her all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife, so that he does not uncover his father's nakedness. Okay, so let's go back to verses 1 through 4. Verses 1 through 4 are pretty much specific applications and a restatement of the law that's found in Leviticus 19, verses verse 18, which says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that also should be familiar to us from the New Testament, because that is still what God commands, that we love our neighbor as ourself. Now, in Israel's time, during this time of this law, there were a few fences and walls on the Jewish farmland, and pretty much the farm animals were allowed to roam free, but they were very important. They were essential to life. Therefore, this life places what we call in the law an affirmative duty. Basically, it requires an exertion of effort to return animals or to board them until they can be returned to the rightful owners. And this was necessary so that life could go on in agricultural Israel. Notice the prohibition of ignoring the situation is not allowed. Three times in verses 1 through 4, God tells the people, you cannot ignore it. You cannot look the other way. You have a duty to do this, because if people don't do it, if people go, Mr. Johnson's cow's out again, and I'm getting ready to go to bed, now I'm going to have to, redress, go out, get this thing, board it, give it water, give it food until I can get it back to him, and it's just a real pain, that's what's required to be done. You cannot ignore it. People are always the same. They've always been the same. Today's the same way. They will look past, they see a need, and we know that we're not to ignore it. We're to love our neighbor as ourselves. But we say, I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the money. I'm getting tired of bailing this guy out. He really needs to take care of his own stuff. Why is it my job to watch out for my neighbor? Or, we hear that in Genesis, am I my brother's keeper? So, yeah, there's an affirmative duty for us. And that's just not just for us Christians. It really is necessary for society in general for us to look out for one another. For when we pull back into our own little self-centered cocoon, life is rough, because life throws at us more than we can handle. And there are times that we need help from other people, and there are times other people need help from us. And we have the affirmative duty not to ignore needs of other people, but to go out and to take care of them. So the animals were required to be returned. And also, not just the animals. Notice it says pretty much anything that your brother loses, a garment, any piece of property that you find, you have the duty to take it back to your brother, or you have the duty to at least find out who it belongs to. Because things are valuable, and when somebody loses something of value, it can affect them, it can affect their family, and God says, no, it's not for you. I provide what you need. So if you think, oh, look what I found, and I'm going to keep this because I can use it, God says, no, that's a lack of faith. You take it back to your brother who it belongs to, and then I will provide you what you need. So if you find his cloak and you need a cloak, you take it back to your brother and you look to me to provide you with a cloak of your own. So that way, God is talking about you cannot ignore. And that seems to be just what we're really good at. So the effort has to be made. Also, if we want to turn back to Exodus 23, 4, and 5, God's law expands that. It says, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. So now we've expanded it. Leviticus here talks about brother, which means somebody from Israel, your neighbor, somebody that you know. But now he's talking about your enemy. If you see your enemy's ox, this guy has been nothing but trouble to you, and now you see his ox wandering, you're like, I'm not going to help him out. He has been nothing but trouble. He's probably going to use that ox to tear down my fences. He's my enemy. The law says you cannot ignore it. You must return your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray. Verse 5 says, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, then you shall refrain from leaving it, leaving it with him or leaving it with the burden. You shall rescue it for him. So in verse 4 and verse 5 are the same. For your neighbor, if you see the animal lying down under the load, fallen in a ditch, you're to help your brother, you're to help your neighbor, you're also to help your enemy. Get that load off, get the animal back up, and get them going on the way. And in this way, when you do this, you're reflecting the glory of your Father that's in heaven, who is kind to the just and to the unjust. Remember, we are called to reflect God's glory. Israel was called to do that as a nation. Now we as the church are called to do that, and the law is the same. Enemy, friend, brother, it doesn't matter. The Good Samaritan, he wasn't a brother. Not necessarily an enemy, but here are the two brothers, the Levite and the priest, walk on the other side. They ignore the beaten Israelite in the parable of the Good Samaritan, but it was the Samaritan that said, this is my neighbor, or maybe this is my enemy. He's a Jewish person and he hates me, but I will take care of him. I will not ignore him, and at my own expense of time and money, I will take care of him. That is what we are called to do, and this law is consistent with every other passage in the Old and New Testament. God does not change. We are not to ignore the needs of others, even if it costs us time, money, or something else that we hold dear. We are to meet the needs of others when we see it and not ignore it. So that's the sum of verses 1 through 4. Verse 5 basically says, a woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. Well, this verse, as well as verses 9 through 12 in this passage, are dealing with making distinctions, in this case, the distinction between a man and a woman. Now, a lot of different churches and a lot of denominations have taken this passage to mean different things. One extreme saying, it's the Old Testament, it's a different time, it's a different culture, we can ignore it completely. And then other people that go so far as to say that women should not have short hair, women shouldn't wear pants, women should just dress like women and men like men, and they're stickler for the law. But most assuredly, this verse is to be understood as a prohibition against transvestitism. It does not allow a person to be a transvestite, one who wants to wear and assume the identity of the other gender. God calls it in this verse an abomination. Now, an abomination is a very, very strong word. It pretty well means anything that is greatly disliked, an intense aversion to something that God has, a loathing. God detests this. It's an abomination. It's vile. It's a shameful action. And the word is saved for the most detestable sins. And here, somebody who is trying to assume the identity of a gender that was not given to him is an abomination to God. This law doesn't only focus on clothing. Literally, it says, there shall not be a man's things upon a woman, and a man shall not put on a woman's clothes. So, now different churches treating this differently, and I don't know. I think that what we can do as Christians, and in the freedom of the law, it's almost like eating the food that has been sacrificed to idols. Paul says, you use your own judgment. If it's okay, if you're a woman and you want to wear slacks or jeans that are made for women, or even if you put on, like my wife is all the time putting on my stuff to go out and muck it up on the farm, that's okay. What this law specifically said is you are not to assume the identity of a woman if you're a man, and you're not to assume the identity of man if you're a woman. You're to be satisfied with the gender that you are. And to try and change that gender, you're saying to God, you did wrong. My will, my desire is contrary to you, and I am the one that will be the ultimate judge of who I am, what I am, and how I act. And they're saying it's the ultimate sin to God. It's the sin that Adam had in the garden. I will have my own way. You're the creator, but I will have my own way, and I revoke and I stand against your right to tell me and to govern over me as God, I will have my own way. And that is sin in its essence. That is lawlessness in its essence. And that is what the person, the transvestite, the homosexual, the transgender, or whatever other words they have to describe what the condition that they say they have, that's what they are doing. God, you will not tell me. I will tell you. I will have my own way. And that is why it is an abomination to God. Now, I'm not saying, so again, I think it should be up to the individual Christian and to their conscience. Some people go and follow the route that, you see the ladies that they wear nothing but skirts. They have the long hair. That's fine. You see ladies that come to church wearing pants, To me, that doesn't bother my conscience whatsoever. I think the dividing line of where this becomes an abomination is when I want to identify with another gender. And that's where that's the line that we should not cross. Other than that, if you feel bad about wearing pants, then don't wear pants. I mean, that's kind of what this is saying. But you, if you are a man, you're born a man, you're to act like a man, and you're to be a man. If you're a woman, you're to act like a woman, you're to be a woman, and we're to be the best men and best women that we can be with all the strength that God gives us. And it's kind of funny how this is falling at the end of Pride Week. You know, it's just, as you can see where our society goes, it's heartbreaking, but you can see that the rebellion of our land is getting more and more intense. Okay, so let's see, that brings us, I believe, to verses 6 and 7. 6 and 7 says, if you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones' eggs, or the mother sitting on the young or the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long. And that one, you know, when you're trying to expound on that verse, that one kind of gave me some problems. So I had to look into, you know, what did other people say about this? Okay, so it's just kind of like, this is kind of a, well, you know, don't take the mother, but you can go ahead and take the eggs, or you can take the young chicks and you can eat them. And from a practical standpoint, you know, the food, what you're doing is you're obtaining food, but you're not killing the source. By leaving the mother bird, then the mother bird can lay more eggs or hatch more young that you can eat, more young chickens. I mean, we had chickens and we did that all the time. We didn't kill the hens and we didn't kill one of the roosters, but we ate the eggs. And then when the chickens hatched out, we let the females live and we ate the males. So maybe, you know, that's just from a practical standpoint. And then it says, you may do that so you may live. And I'm sorry, I tried to find something spiritual about that, but I'm going to be very remiss about trying to spiritualize something in the Bible that I'm not sure of. And so that is something that maybe if somebody sees something later on, they can tell me, hey, Coker, you really missed it. This is what it means spiritually. But I am going to be very sure when I'm standing in a pulpit of the living God and saying this is what God says, I'm going to be very sure it's what God says before I say it. So using caution, we're going to move on to verse 8. Verse 8 says, when you build a new house, you shall make a parapet, or basically that's a railing, for your roof, that you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it. Now, this is a concern for others, and it, again, requires an affirmative duty and effort. It's basically a call not to be criminally negligent. When you build houses, and back in that time in Israel, a lot of the houses had a flat roof. And on the roof, there were things that were done. I mean, there was parties, there was work. People would meet up there. Normally, you could make it up to the roof by an outside stairwell and get onto the roof. And we all remember the, you know, the guys that had the paralyzed man, and they brought him up, and then they cut a hole in the roof and let him down. So you could access the roof without going through the house. So it's basically telling the people of Israel, if you're going to build a new house, put a railing around the roof so somebody doesn't fall off and die and their blood is on your head because you could have put that on there when you built the new house to prevent them from that. And because of an accident, they're dead and you're criminally negligent for doing it. And you could be guilty of murder if somebody falls off the roof. So oftentimes throughout Israel, we see these practical things that God commands. And again, because you would have people, and people are always the same, they're always born into sin, they're always looking out for their best interest and not really caring for others, this is saying you're going to have to stop, and when you build a new house, you're going to have to think about other people, and you're going to have to use an affirmative duty and exert effort for their needs. So that's kind of a theme that's developing in these verses that we have. All right, verses 9 through 12, again, we're about distinctions. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed. lest the whole yield be forfeited, the crop that you have sown and the yield of the vineyard. You shall not plow with an ox or a donkey together, and you shall not wear cloth of wool and linen mixed together. You shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. So, this is somewhat of a restatement of Leviticus 19:19, which says, you shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle breed with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor shall you wear a garment of cloth made of two kinds of material. Now, the reasons for these regulations, not really clear again like we have before. Practically, you know, you can say, I don't want to put an ox and a donkey together. You know, an ox is very powerful but slow, and a donkey is fast but not so powerful. And if you put them together, one's going to be doing most of the work, and you're not going to be able to plow a straight line. Plus, they're probably not going to get together. I don't know of how you're going to get an ox and a donkey under the same yoke. So don't do it. Don't try and do it. Practically, it's just a bad idea. Or with the seed, sometimes I think they do that to maintain healthy crops. You plant one field with one seed and one kind of grain or whatever you're planting, so that when you harvest, it's easy. You harvest in one way. You harvest grapes in a way different than you harvest wheat. And then you can harvest different grains, I think, in a way than what you harvest other grains. I'm not a farmer by any means, but from a practical standpoint, it's just best to keep one thing in one field. However, when something is merely practical and makes sense, is this law really needed? You know, for the example, the ox and the donkey or sowing your field, why would you need a law? Because you would think if you're a farmer, you would know this by instinct. So why does God make this a law? Well, more likely the purposes of these verses is to teach the importance of creation order distinctions, to remind Israel of her call, of her purity, of her separation from the surrounding nations. That's what I believe these verses are calling for. You need to be reminded that you are separate from the world. So therefore, you will have one field with one kind of grain. You will not mix a donkey and an ox. You will not mix fibers in your clothes. You know, and of course, they had the practical thing. Well, you know, maybe one would shrink faster than the other and distort the garment. But I think what God is saying is, Israel, you're separate. You're to maintain your separateness from the world, and these are reminders that you are to remain separate. Ephesians 5:11, even we as the church are to remain separate from the world. It tells us, take no part in the worthless deeds of evil and darkness. Instead, expose them. And James 1 really talks about how we are to remain separate. James 1 speaks of the double-minded man or the man of divided loyalty, that when you're asking for wisdom, to make sure that you ask and that your loyalty is not divided, that you're not double-minded, you're not a fence straddler. The double-minded man, the man with divided loyalty, is saying, you know what, I'm going to take earthly wisdom when earthly wisdom benefits me, and I'm going to take spiritual wisdom when spiritual wisdom benefits me. And what does the Bible say in James 1? It says, this man is unstable in everything that he does. His loyalties are divided. So even in the New Testament, God is saying, church, you are separate from the world. You are to be separate and distinct. You are not to take part in the worthless deeds of unbelievers. And you are not to take the world's wisdom and mix it with the wisdom that I give you. We are completely separate. In fact, James 4:4 in the New Living, I love this. This is a great translation. It's not a word for word, but it is a beautiful thought translation. It says, you adulterers, don't you realize that friendship with this world makes you an enemy of God? I say it again, that if your aim is to enjoy this world, you can't be a friend of God. If it's your main aim to enjoy yourself in this world, you cannot be a friend of God. We are to be separate. So these verses point to Israel. You need to remain separate. The New Testament church, you need to remain separate. And these things were to remind Israel of their separateness. And the reason I say that is then we go to the tassels in verse 12. Verse 12 says, you shall make for yourself tassels on the four corners of your garments which you cover yourself. Now, what are the purposes of these tassels? Well, if we turn to Numbers 15, 37 through 39, God says, you know, the tassels, he tells us not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. Okay. Not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. That is a very strong word. So don't follow your own heart. Don't follow your own eyes. Proverbs 14:12 basically said there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end is, excuse me, but its end is the way to death. And Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? It's saying these tassels are to remind you that there's a way, there's a heart that you will follow after. In fact, Jerry talked about it very clearly today. It's the flesh that stays with us. It's our own way. We are going to do what we want to do no matter what God tells us. The tassels were to remind us, you are prone to go your own way. Isaiah, we like sheep have all gone astray, each to our own ways. You whore after it. There's a way that seems right to man. It ends in death. The heart is deceitful. The tassels were an aid to remember the commandment to do the law. The tassels were to remind them, you are separate. You cannot follow your own way. You are God's. And now the church says, we are God's. We are bought with a price. We are not our own. So, today, what can we do to remind us like the tassels? Because this is very helpful. And I just happen to have an illustration. This is my law school class ring. Now, it looks like a regular high school class ring, and I did that on purpose because I don't want it to look like I'm putting on airs. So that's to help me to remember to be humble, that even though I graduated from law school, it was God that gave me Chris that was able to work while I went to law school. It was God that gave me the ability to study to get through law school. So this speaks to my accomplishment of graduating law school, but it's not anything that I should brag about. So it looks like an ordinary high school class ring, and people mistake it for a high school class ring all the time. You'll notice the stone is black. That stone is completely worthless. It's black, and it's probably not worth 25 cents. That's me. That's me. Without God, I'm worthless, I'm black, and I have no use to anybody. The only thing that makes that stone valuable is it's surrounded by gold. The gold represents God. God is everything that in my life that gives me value is because of God. And so the gold that surrounds it and it shines, and I love these lights because it makes it shine so beautifully. When I see something in my life that shines, it's God. It's the gold. It's not the black. It's not the worthless. And then I've even had it kind of colored with a little black, kind of like they call it the antique look. The black under the gold. Now, there's still gold under the black, but that's to remind me I'm going to mess up. And when I mess up, there's still underneath me God supporting me in my sin so that I'm still worth something in God's eyes, but only because of the gold of Christ who bought me and purchased me as his own. That's my tassel. That's why I wear that. And it does remind you, and sometimes because like being a lawyer, you go to these classes. Now, of course, being in Okemah, it's not hard to remain humble. I mean, it really isn't. But you go to these places, and these lawyers, they're driving the cars, they have the nice suits, and they're all acting, and it's like this big show. It kind of reminds me of the parable of how the, you know, people at the big dinner, and they're all jockeying for the seats and everything like that. But it is very easy to get taken up with the worldly illusion of power and money when you go to these continuing legal education seminars. You go in wearing a ring that looks like a class ring, driving a Honda, wearing jeans instead of a suit. God helps me to stay that way. But this is my tassel. And so it's really helpful. I mean, if y'all can figure out something that you can have in your life that can remind you not to go your own way, because when the temptation comes and you look down and you see the ring, and I go, oh, the first thing I see is the black. It's like, that's you. You're worthless, man. You're worthless. So there's my tassel. I thought I'd use that as a little kind kind of a... Now, it's really fun. I'm glad I can get it on because I've gotten so fat lately. I've had trouble getting it on. So God was merciful today, and I was able to get it on and off. Okay. So now we're going to skip to laws. It says laws concerning sexual immorality. There's a fella, and I don't know who he is, but I just love his quote. His name's Fulton Sheen, and I have no idea what he is, who he is, if he's alive or dead, but I saw this quote, and Warren Wiersbe, I was one of the commentaries I was looking at preparing, and this quote was there, and I thought, this is a good quote. Sex has become one of the most discussed subjects of modern times. The Victorians pretended it did not exist, and the moderns pretend that nothing else exists. That's pretty well our society. Everything is sold with sex. Sex is what is on everybody's mind. People are being exposed to it at a younger age. And what we are being told is that it's the end all. This is the reason for living. Everything revolves around this, which is kind of sad because if something happens to you and you're no longer able to partake in it, then you know what does that leave? Well, at least, what was his name? The author that killed himself. Oh, I can't remember. Hemingway. Hemingway was at least honest. He had money. He had fame. He had women. And when he got too old, he killed himself because there was no reason to live when all of that went away. At least he was intellectually honest about his life. It was a sad life. But the things of this earth will all pass away. There will be a time that if you have it all, you don't take it with you. When you die, it stays here. Sex is God's creation, and it is a beautiful picture and practice of intimacy between two people. In marriage, it's between a man and a woman within the bonds of marriage, and it is a picture of communion that we have with our Creator in our relationship with Christ. And verses 13 through 21 talks about the sexual purity. Now, the sexual purity of a woman was important in Israel, and the reason was it was to maintain the integrity of the family and therefore of the tribes. So the legitimacy of a man's sons, a man's lineage, was guaranteed in the protection and perception of the family. So when it's saying that it was important that a man marry a virgin, because if a man marries a woman who's not a virgin, then she could already be pregnant, and the son that she bears may not be his. So that's why this was so important, that the virginity of a daughter of Israel could bring about the death for misconduct. The issue was both personal morality and family legitimacy. If the bride was not a virgin, then all doubt was placed on her, all doubt of the legitimacy of the kids now is made manifest and exists. So there's a procedure for the man to protect himself and his bloodline. But God, in his mercy and his perfection, made a law where it also protects the woman should a man decide, I'm not happy with her and I want to dump her and I need a good reason to get rid of her, so I'm just going to make this accusation. So God, in his perfection, gives us a procedure of an accusation that can be made. So what do we have is man takes the wife, and of course they have the wedding ceremony. I'm going to spare everybody the details of that. We all know what happens. And then apparently there was a cloth that the virgin was lying on that goes to the parents of the bride after the honeymoon ceremony. And the blood on the cloth was proof of virginity. So if the man says this woman was not a virgin, she's pregnant, or she's not a virgin, then the parents would produce the proof. If the man was lying and he defamed and slandered the woman and their family, his punishment was to be beaten or whipped, and then he was to pay, in addition to the 50 shekels for a bride, 100 shekels, which is twice the bride's pay, back to the bride's father for defaming his daughter. And they guess that to be probably take almost 10 years to pay off 100 shekels for the average Jewish person in that time. So the fine was pretty heavy for him defaming. And so, of course, we know what the reason for that was. Don't make that accusation unless it's not true, because it will not go well with you. And then he can't divorce the woman at all for any reason. And so that's another thing to protect her. Now you will have to support her. You might not like her. Maybe that's why you made this accusation. But you will support her, and you will give her her full rights as your wife for as long as you live. And you may never get rid of her. You may never divorce her. But if, on the other hand, the woman was not a virgin, then the woman was to be taken to her father's house and stoned to death. And this was because she had committed an atrocity in her father's house by laying with another man before she was married. And, of course, it says, so that you will purge evil from Israel. And, you know, being stoned is a pretty good, you know, knowing that this would happen, that's a pretty good way of stopping people and making them stop and think, you know what, if I do this, if I sleep with somebody before marriage, it's going to be found out. The marriage cloth is going to be clean because I'm not a virgin and I will be stoned. Again, that's a pretty good way of saying, yeah, you better think about this before you do it. And it's a way of where people would be afraid of the law. And then when people actually were brazen enough to break the law of God, that held the law of God in contempt, they were killed, they were taken away, and evil was purged from the land. So we're talking very severe, but we're also talking very fair in the way that God set up the system to protect the man and to protect the woman. And the same thing happens when we look at verses 22, adultery. Now, adultery is part of the Ten Commandments that said you should not commit adultery, and the punishment for adultery is death. And I noticed that, you know, people will talk about the fact that all throughout history, even in the pagan nations, adultery was considered very bad. Even in the pagan nations, like when Abraham was in Egypt, and his wife was taken into the concubine of the Egyptian Pharaoh, and he says, you know what, God spared me from committing this great sin of sleeping with your wife. Why did you do this to me? Why did you say she was your sister? Well, Egypt was by no means God's chosen race. But yet, even pagan Egypt, who worshipped idols and sun gods and what have you, even they held marriage in a very high esteem. Today, what happened? What happened? We have novels, we have TV shows, we have movies, we have music that all puts adultery. We're sexually free. In the 60s, we had the sexual revolution. Well, what were we free of? Well, Psalm says it pretty good. The people shake their fist at God and say, we're going to break your yoke. We're going to be free to do what we want, we're going to go our own way. And America took a shift. America says, God, we reject your way. And when it comes to sexual freedom, if it feels good, do it. If we want to break the yokes, we don't want your convention of marriage. We don't want to be tied down. We should be free to love whoever we want, when we want, however we want. And God, what are you going to do about it? That was in the 60s. Now we come 50, almost 60 years later. Here's what God did about it. Just like Romans, it says in Romans 1, God gave them over to their depraved mind. God says, okay, have your fun. Do what you want. Follow your own way. But guess what? You get the consequences that come with it. We are now reaping the fruit that was sown back in the 60s. If it feels good, do it. If it follows your own way, yeah, sin is fun for a time. But look at this. Unwed, single mothers, kids that are abused and treated like garbage. We can't get enough foster parents for the kids that have been taken away because their parents want to do what their parents want to do. Yeah. I have seen cases. I have been, over the years, appointed to represent parents whose kids were taken away. That's hard to represent sometimes. Sometimes they needed to be taken away, sometimes they didn't. But I've seen really atrocious cases where parents have been so self-centered that that's all they think of. The child is a nuisance. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, do you know what? Since the child's a nuisance, we're going to do the child a favor. Since the child is unwanted and it's going to, you know, kind of get in our way, we're just going to abort the child. We're going to kill the child before they even get started. And that way, the child doesn't have to grow up being unwanted. Do we see how twisted and how messed up this thinking is? And when we look at the perfect law of God, it's an abomination. But this is what's happened in our country. We have taken marriage and we've said, it's not that big of a deal. I don't need a piece of paper to love somebody. No, you need a commitment. You need to make a vow before God that until death do us part, I will love, honor, cherish you. You will be more important to me than I am to myself. That's the oath that is taken in marriage. And that's the oath that this country as a whole shuns, and as the world shuns. And we are now reaping the fruit of the poisonous seeds of self-centeredness that were planted. Now, they've always been there. They've always been there. I mean, there's always been adultery. There's always been divorce. There's always been bad, abusive parents. But we've really, as a country, we've embraced the sin. And with the abortions and the blood that's crying out from the ground, with the Pride Week, where we have people that are saying to God, you got it wrong, God, I'm a boy. Or you got it wrong, God, I'm really a girl. Or you got it wrong, God, I want to have sex with men, and I'm a man, or I'm a woman, and I want to have sex with woman. And God, I'm going to do what I want. What are you going to do about it? Folks, America has shaken its fist in God's face and said, what are you going to do about it? When I read Isaiah and the prophets, I do tremble. Because I do not see how God can keep from judging us at this point. Now, God knows how to save those who are His. But also remember that when Israel went to judgment, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego also went into exile. Now, God blessed them and God protected them. But we need to understand that a lot of the persecution that I talked about last time that I was up here is warranted. It's going to be judgment persecution on America. Now, the persecution I'm talking about for Christians is the unwarranted when we, as Jerry, I love his analogy. When you preach the law, you're poking the bear. When we preach Christ, when we preach this law, we're poking the bear, and that's where our persecution is going to come from. But as a whole, I do not see how God, in his sovereignty, in his purity, cannot judge this country for what we have done. Now, what are we supposed to do as the church? We're supposed to stand up and faithfully proclaim. We are to live and proclaim God's truth day by day, hour by hour, using God's words and meeting people where they're at and giving them the gospel. Whether or not they accept the gospel, that's up to God. We know that. But we're to be proclaiming it, and we're to be proclaiming it to the end. So, adultery. If a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall purge evil from the land. We have not purged evil from our land, and now we are ripe for judgment. Verse 23, if there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man because he violated his neighbor's wife, so you shall purge evil from your midst. Again, we see God's perfection in his law protecting the innocent and not protecting and punishing the guilty. In this case, as both people are presumed guilty, the woman is presumed to have consent. She can say, oh, I was raped, but the law says, well, wait, you were in the city. Did you cry out? Did you cry out for help and somebody could rescue you and then prove that you are not consenting to this act, that you truly were raped? If you were in the city and you did not cry out, then you're presumed to have consented to it. But if you're in the open country and nobody can hear you cry out, and that's in verse 25, but if in the open country a man meets a woman who is betrothed, and remember, betrothal, the engagement, it's just the same as being married. That was kind of what Mary was to Joseph, even though they had not had the actual marriage ceremony and the marriage had not been consummated. They were betrothed, so it required a divorce if he was going to get rid of her. So, if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lie with her shall die. Because she could have cried for help and we don't know. So the presumption is that she did, that she was raped, that she cried for help and there is no one to rescue her. Then the man, the rapist, must die, but she is allowed to go free. It says in verse 26, but you shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense punishable by death. For this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor because he met her in the open country. And though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. So again, you see how God protects the innocent but punishes the guilty. Verse 28, if a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her and they are found, then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver. That's the price for the bride. The guy that, you know, defamed the woman had to pay 100. That was double the price for the bride. And she shall be his wife because he has violated her. And he may not divorce her all his days. Folks, now that sounds bad. Could you imagine something, a relationship that starts off with lust in the heart of a man, and now he has to marry her and he can't divorce her, and basically the relationship started off with a rape? That's not going to be a happy marriage. I think that man's going to get everything that he deserved. And then 30, a man shall not take his father's wife, and that's meaning his stepmother, so that he does not uncover his father's nakedness. This was mentioned that we see in 1 Corinthians where the man was living with his stepmother in an incestuous relationship. And Paul says, church, even the pagans don't do this. And you're allowing this to happen? Well, again, this, you know, people say, well, how did we know it was wrong? Well, it's in the law of God. It's in the Old Testament. So even before that happened, even before, and again, the pagans, like with adultery, they seem to esteem the laws of God more than God's people do. It's embarrassing. But we are to keep the marriage bed sacred. We are to keep marriage sacred and hold it up high. Divorce is way too easy in this country. Everything is too easy. If you don't like what's happening, if you don't like a wife, get rid of her. Well, that's not what the Bible says. And you know what? There's things in those vows, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health. I don't see, it's like, if she becomes inconvenient, if she gets on your nerves, if she gets fat, of course that's worked the other way in my marriage. Chris still loves me. There's more of me to love. Yeah. But the vows are sacred. The vows are sacred, and that's for the stability of society and for the children. I know people that were adults when their parents got divorced, and they said, oh, well, we waited till the kids got grown because, you know, if they're children, that would hurt. Now, I don't care if you're 50 and your parents are in their 70s, that they get divorced, that hurts your kids. That hurts your kids. Marriage is sacred. Sex is a sacred gift to be enjoyed inside the bounds of marriage, and it's between a man and a woman, and it's a beautiful divine picture of the communion and intimacy that we have with God. One of my favorite verses that talks about God has a stone. And on the stone, there's a name written that only you and God know. Well, you know what that saying? It's like, I am so big, and I don't know how many people are going to end up in heaven. I hope a lot, but let's say billions of people are in heaven that God has chosen to be his. But God is so big that they said, there's a piece of me that is yours and no one else can have. See, isn't that a picture of marriage? Chris and I were laughing because, you know, anybody that's been married for any length of time, there are things that happen that are going to die with those two people. And rightfully so. There are funny things. There are wonderful things. There are things that, you know, let's hope the kids don't find out about this one. But there are things that are shared between a man and a woman that are not for anybody else. And we will be able to share that with the infinite God of the universe in heaven. And this is a wonderful, beautiful picture of that intimacy, of that communion. And we should not violate it here on earth. And then we'll be able to enjoy it in heaven forever. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your wonderful word. Thank you for your wonderful law. Thank you for your grace and your mercy and your justice. Thank you that you know the end from the beginning and that you're faithful. Lord, as we go out today, I pray that you would be with us. Guide us. Help us to remember that we are to be separate and that we are to take our strength from you. I just pray that we would praise your name and reflect your glory in all that we do. In Christ's name, amen.